around the waist and flipped me over.
Happy now?
Yes. I tried to deflail my limbs and arrange myself somewhat sexily, which was actually kind of difficult when I couldn't see, and was right in the middle of my own wet spot. It's better like this. Awkward pause. Isn't it? This time his soft laugh was nothing but fondness. His fingers brushed my lips and then the tip of my nose, tweaked at my nipple rings, traced the tattoo at my hip.
Much.
He tapped the inside of my knee.
Now show me what's mine.
All of me is yours. Heat was trickling over me, gathering in the places I thought he might be looking. Considering less than a minute ago I'd been lying in a wobbly heap with my arse in the air, it shouldn't have felt any more exposing to spread my legs on command. But somehow it did. Didn't stop me, though. And actually made my cock perk back up. I just never knew when to quit. That's my problem. He gave a rough growl, and presumably got back to masturbating. Sure, I can't do anything, I said. Give you a helping? He put his hand lightly over my mouth, which I entirely deserved. Giggling, I kissed his fingers, and then sucked on them.
Oh, God. Un.
It was such an amazing groan that I couldn't help myself. And I cheated. I peeked. The quickest glance from between my lashes. And fuck, it was worth it. He was flushed and rumpled, his head thrown back, his neck all strong and straining, and his expression half frowning, half helpless. Completely beautiful. And then I felt guilty as fuck because he'd trusted me and I'd epically failed to be worthy of it. What it came down to was, I was Orpheus hanging around at the gates of Tartarus and being like, sheesh, dude, it was only a glance, to Hades. I squeezed my eyes tightly shut so I wouldn't be tempted again. Concentrated instead on doing the lewdest possible things to Caspian's fingers. And he came a few seconds later with a naked cry that, for once, he didn't even try to stifle. I actually jerked when his cum splashed over me, impossibly hot for the split second of its landing. "Can I look now?" I asked. Or rather, "Can I look out?" On account of my tongue being somewhat occupied.
"If you must."
I stared at him, hungrily, but he was almost back together by now. I mean, he still looked like he just had sex, flushed and sweaty, his chest heaving and his hair curling at the tips. But I wanted to see him in the wildness of the moment, lost and vulnerable and free. It was kind of sad-making he didn't want to share that with me. Even more sad-making that he didn't feel able to share it with anyone. Orgasms weren't supposed to be lonely. It made me want to snuggle him without mercy. But I knew he wouldn't be into it. So I grinned up at him instead and pulled his fingers from between my lips with the wettest plop I could manage. He winced adorably. I let him go, dabbed up a splash of semen from my stomach and licked it off my thumb.
Un.
He sounded almost shocked. 5-second rule, and you're delicious.
That's ridiculous. And untrue.
How do you know? Have you tasted?
Well, not myself. But I'm familiar with the...
I somehow didn't completely crack up at the sight of Caspian Hart trying to find whatever he deemed an appropriate word for cum.
Substance.
He finished. And you're not a fan? Wait.
Did this mean Nathaniel had funky spunk?
Oh, please, God, I hoped he did.
I don't have an aversion.
Caspian took off his jacket and tossed it over the end of the bed.
I just wouldn't actively seek opportunities to imbibe it.
I didn't say I'd eat it on chips, but it's you. And I like you. He'd gone pinkish.
Why are we talking about this?
You started it.
I absolutely did not.
Yes, you did. He stretched himself out over me, trapping me cozily beneath his body and kissed my nose.
No, I didn't.
Your clothes?
I protested, though it was way, way too late.
I would have had to change anyway.
Great. After all the trouble I went to in order to ensure nobody would have to clean my jizz off Caspian's carpet, now it was going to be somebody's job to get it out of his bespoke, probably Italian suit. Two looks in one day. You're the Kim Kardashian of financial management.
I'm who?
Oh, my God! My voice shook with the laughter caught in it. You really have been in more magazines than you've read.
That's an accurate assessment.
He kissed me again, mouth this time, and then rolled away, settling on his back beside me, one arm flung casually above his head. I curled into the space. It was something I was getting weirdly good at, lying hopefully in the shape of a hug. I was close enough to feel the heat from his body, to smell the sex on him, but he still didn't touch me. Maybe, I said, we could do a knowledge exchange. His eyebrow twitched. I could teach you about popular culture, like any popular culture, and you could...
educate you on the impact of emerging economies on price movement in global equity, currency, and commodity markets.
I was thinking more... get me into sci-fi. I wasn't sure how seriously I'd meant it, but he tensed right up.
I'm hardly an expert.
It's not about expertise, so much as, you know, sharing something with you. That you like, I mean. I stretched an arm over the side of the bed and groped around in the box until I found Down Below Station. Could I borrow this, maybe? There was a horrible silence. Shit, it was your dad's, wasn't it? Caspian covered his face with his hands.
It's not that I don't trust you.
No, God, no, I know that. Don't worry about it.
There's just... when someone dies, there's so little of them left.
I get it, I really do. Wow, oh, wow, I was a complete fuck trumpet. Caspian's generosity to me was boundless. Ridiculous, even. And here I was, casually asking him to lend me his last connection to his dead father. I'm so sorry. Forget I ever said it. I wish I could touch him. I felt so helpless lying there, babbling out apologies that were probably washing over him like water, when all I wanted to do was draw him close and hold him tight. Make him truly believe he was safe with me. That I would take nothing from him he feared to lose. Didn't choose to give. Eventually he emerged, letting out a long, careful breath.
No, it's me. I'm being foolish. Of course you can.
No, I cried. I mean, it was incredibly touching that he was willing. But it was the last thing I wanted now that I understood what I'd actually been asking. I mean, sheesh. Paper books? Who reads those anymore? I bet I could pick this up for 99p as an EPUB. He gave a slight shaken laugh. I grabbed my phone and Googled. Well, okay, $11.99 if I pretend I'm American.
Arden, I don't mind.
I do. That thing's like 500 pages. It weighs a ton. Suddenly his arms came around me and he pulled me close, turning the space into a nook, my body tucked into his. To me, at least, it felt perfect. Like I belonged there. And I couldn't help wriggling in even closer. By the way, I think your meeting might be a bust.
Oh, fuck.
Caspian swore so rarely that it always sounded extra filthy, and therefore extra sexy when he did. He pulled out his phone and dialed with a deft swipe.
Belrose, cancel that call, please.
A pause.
No, that's fine. Yes. Yes, I'll leave it too. Thank you.
I'm sorry I made you miss your thing, I said once he'd hung up, only lying a little bit. Was it important?
Terribly important. But so am I. And it can wait.
I tried not to smirk.
You know...
Caspian gave me a wry look.
You don't seem all that sorry.
I'm abstractly sorry, but I like being with you too much to be completely sorry. He laughed, his hand finding its way to my arse and giving it a squeeze. The fabric of his suit was slightly rough against my nipples, making me very aware of the fact that he was, once again, fully clothed and I was Starkers. It was kind of the way things tended to go with us. Mostly I didn't mind, and there were times when the sense of personal exposure was definitely part of the fun. But from another perspective, it was bizarre. After all, I looked like me, decent-ish but nothing special, and Caspian was absolutely spectacular. If I'd been him, I would have been naked whenever I could get away with it. Honestly, I'd probably never stop wanking, while taking selfies of myself. Narcissus for the social media age. I snuggled in closer, just content to bask in the time that Caspian had unexpectedly given me.
"Do you mind if I smoke?"
he asked after a minute or two. He told me when we first met, on a moonlit night in Oxford that seemed forever ago now. He allowed himself one cigarette a month, something to do with controlling his vices. Which didn't make sense to me because if there was one thing Caspian Hart could have done with a bit less of, it was control. I wasn't entirely sure what it meant that he wanted to indulge himself here, now, with me. But it was intimacy of a kind, and I sure as hell wasn't going to say no. Course not. My bedside table was a pervert smorgasbord of lube and condoms and exciting things to put up your arse or wrap around your knob. I didn't get much of a look at Caspian's, but I was pretty sure there was nothing inside of it except a book, a lighter, a saucer I guessed he was using as an ashtray, and a packet of Dunhill. With an arm around me, he was a little clumsy lighting up, and then he lay back against the pillows, still holding me tight. And took a deep, luxurious drag. His eyes fell half-closed, smoke billowing from between his parting lips. It made me desperate to kiss him, feel the surrender of his mouth. He hadn't wanted me to see him come, but he let me see this. The one pleasurable yielding he seemed able to countenance. Caspian... What did you write on me yesterday?
It's from the Lathe of Heaven.
One of the many problems of being an English literature student, especially if you went to Oxford, was that people expected you to have read everything, thus condemning you to a life of lying, bullshitting, and incipient shame. I opened my mouth to make a bland statement that implied familiarity with the text without committing myself to anything. And then I thought, fuck it. No. Caspian already knew I'd only pretended to have read Ulysses. He wasn't going to think less of me because I hadn't read The Lathe of Heaven. And there was no reason for me to think less of myself either. I don't know it, I announced triumphantly.
Why would you, since you're not into sci-fi? It's Ursula Le Guin, about a man who has the ability to change reality through his dreams.
I can see why you might be into that. He smiled faintly.
It's not quite what you think. The protagonist is very much a dreamer, passive to a fault. It's other people who want to change the world, usually with disastrous consequences.
I sighed. You know, that's another thing I don't get about science fiction. For a genre that's supposed to be all about technology and progress and the future, why does it always turn out to be a massive disaster whenever anybody tries to do anything or change anything?
You tell me, Mr. B.A. Oxen.
I guess because a lot of genre fiction has its roots in the 19th century when we had more rigid ideas about God and social order. And check me out, sounding like I know what the fuck I'm talking about.
That's because you do. Though, for what it's worth, I don't think this book is actually saying that. I think it's more about the complexities of the world and its problems. Especially the problems that are connected to the complexities of people. My father.
He paused, cleared his throat.
My father always said Le Guin was primarily interested in people.
Isn't science fiction supposed to be about ideas? Caspian swallowed.
It is, but it can also be very, very human. Since a lot of the time it's concerned with human questions. At least that's what my father believed.
He shifted and I could feel him getting self-conscious. This was usually the moment he would pull away from me. But to my surprise he gave a slightly rueful laugh and went on.
No wonder I read PPE.
I thought... I gave him a naughty look. You were leveraging the Oxford brand to something-something the something-something.
That too.
He let his voice slip into its driest, coolest register.
To lead a successful life, it is vital to something-something the something-something.
I giggled, hopelessly heart-eyed. I adored everything about Caspian. His strength, his ferocity, his delicious cruelty. But this side of him, his secret capacity to laugh at himself, never failed to delight me.
But I think a large part of it, he murmured, came down to being able to study philosophy. It gave me an excuse to keep thinking about the sorts of things my father liked to think about.
I was starting to wonder if maybe I'd developed the power to affect reality by dreaming. Except I wouldn't have dreamed this in a gazillion years. I wouldn't have dared. It seemed too impossible. We'd had an argument, fixed it, discussed stuff, and now we were actually cuddling. And he was talking to me. His body warm and relaxed against mine. His eyes a dark, slumberous blue, like the sea when you swam out too far. And then his phone bleeped a reminder. He glanced up at it grumpily and sighed.
I'm sorry, Arden. I have to get moving. Do you want anything from Paris?
Yes, I grinned at him. I want you to come back super quick and eat ridiculously expensive sushi off my restrained, naked, helplessly aroused body. He was laughing as he caught up my hand and kissed it.
I'll see what I can do. You promise? Promises are for children.
And lovers.
He held my gaze for a long time. But he was the one running late, and I wasn't backing down.
Then, he said finally, I promise, my Arden.
Chapter 14. Unfortunately, when Friday rolled round, I was too wrecked for anything we'd planned and promised and hoped for. Instead, I was sitting on the sofa, dazed and half-crying, and clutching helplessly at my phone. It was only when Caspian said,
Arden, what's wrong?
That I realized he was there, or even remembered that he was supposed to be coming. I glanced up, noted, with a terrible sense of distance, how lovely he looked just then. Charcoal grey suit, lilac shirt, and in what must have been a moment of unusual opulence, a Liberty print tie in shades of silver and indigo. God, he dressed for me. And I was... It's Nick! The words burst out of me in a teary blurble. He's been hit by a car or something. I don't know. He's in surgery. That's bad, isn't it, when people are in surgery? Caspian was silent for a moment, startled, possibly.
Well, it depends on the surgery.
Right. I... My attention reeled from Caspian to the apartment. I didn't get any sushi.
Forget the sushi. I'm sorry to hear about your friend.
Yeah. For the first time in my life, I wanted Caspian to go away. I needed to freak the fuck out, and having him standing there, all calm and pristine and vaguely concerned, was cramping my style.
You should be with him.
He was saying with uncertain gentleness I remembered all too well from my other crises.
What hospital? I'll call a car.
I can't be with him. He's in fucking Boston. That was when I started crying. Properly this time. Not the anxious eye-prickling of the shocked, but the full-on wailing of the terrifying and traumatized. And I'm supposed to be his next of kin! Caspian tugged out his pocket square, which turned out to be purple and polka-dotted, unusually playful for my austere Mr. Hart, and pressed it into my hand.
What about his parents?
He hates them! I should probably tell them, but I don't know if he'd even want them there. Words kept coming, muddling with my tears, until everything was a mess. And his ex-girlfriend's in Paris, and I can't get hold of her, and I have £50.56 in my bank account right now, and a flight to Boston is like 800 quid, and I don't think my family could afford it, but they wouldn't say no, so I can't ask, and there's nobody over there that will really tell me what's happened, except there's been a crash and Nick's in hospital, and he's all alone in a strange country full of Americans, and oh God, they don't even have NHS over there, and I don't actually know how insurance works, and what if he dies? What if he's already dead, or they've thrown his broken body out the window because he didn't have gazillions of dollars on hand to pay for medical care. At last, I stopped talking. I was nowhere near out of panic, but I was definitely out of breath. Also, most of the water in my body was erupting from my eyes, so my mouth wouldn't work anymore except for strange, sticky gulping noises.
Excuse me,
said Caspian.
I have to make a call.
He stepped briskly away from me. I heard his footsteps carry him down the hall, the click of a door closing, the soft murmur of his voice. He could have been saying anything, like, please get me away from this crazy weeping person. I couldn't blame him. He'd come here for sexy fun times, not deal with hysterical breaking Arden times. Seeing him turn away like that. It had hurt. A dull pain upon a deeper one. A careless knock against already bruised flesh. I was calmer, though. Not particularly in a feeling better way. So much as hollowed out. His pocket square was still crumpled in my sweaty fist, so I used it to wipe my face. I tried so hard, it was like I'd exfoliated myself, and even the silk felt rough against my skin. Also, snot. There was quite a lot of that. Caspian must have really enjoyed the sight of me tonight. And why the fuck was I worried about looking disgusting when Nick was... At that moment, Caspian came back in. Oh, God, I was ugly and awful, and he'd seen me. Sorry about that. I made a valiant attempt to pull myself together. I was just a bit... Anyway, do you want to get that sushi?
Stop talking about sushi.
Sorry. Usually I liked Caspian's commands, finding not harshness there, but the opposite. A kind of caretaking. Unfortunately, I was in no state to be strong or understanding or react to anything except the surface of things. So it felt like a slap. Made me flinch. He sighed, crouched in front of me, drowned me in the sweet familiar scents of his body and his cologne.
Look at me, Arden.
I wouldn't. I couldn't. He caught the edge of my jaw and forced me. I didn't even have it in me right then to resent it. Just blinked at him with swollen eyes.
The car will be here in 10 minutes,
he said.
The jet will be ready in 30. Belrose will meet you at Heathrow.
My brain was static. Wait, what?
I said you should be with your friend, and I meant it.
But I can't!
You can, and you will. Now go and pack.
For some reason, the simplicity of that, of going and packing, cut through the numbness of my body and the emptiness of my mind. I rose jerkily and stumbled toward the bedroom. Then something made me stop. Look back at Caspian. I don't know how it happened, if he moved first or I did. But his arms opened for me and I rushed into them. And he held me. His embrace tight and warm and absolute, with nothing held back. It was overwhelming. Overwhelming in a way I desperately needed. The purity of his affection. The ferocity of his solace. I pressed myself against him, shuddering. And he let me stay. His hand crept into my hair, soothing me.
It's going to be all right, my Arden.
How do you know?
Because I will do everything in my power to make it so.
My eyes burned as if they wanted to shed more tears. You can't stop someone from dying.
No, but I can give your friend the best possible chance. And I can make sure you're by his side if the worst happens.
There was a silence. Beneath my cheek, his heart pulsed, its rhythm unwavering within its cage of flesh and bone. It seemed impossible that something so powerfully vital could ever falter, or stop altogether. I got snot on your pocket square, I mumbled.
Then I will have it dry cleaned.
He unpeeled me carefully, stroked the moisture from my cheeks with his thumb.
Now, you really do need to pack.
I nodded, bent my head to swiftly kiss the inside of his wrist, felt his responsive shiver, and went. My sense of time was blurry, but I was pretty sure it didn't take long to fling a handful of clothes into my trundly and zip it up. And then Caspian took me down to the car, steering me expertly with one hand at the small of my back like we were guests at a cocktail party. I was trying to find words to thank him. Any words would do, but the magnitude of what was happening was simply too great. And then I was in the car and it was too late anyway. At Heathrow, I was taken to a special entrance where I was greeted by name and whisked off to a private lounge. As promised, Belrose was there, looking far too elegant for a man who had presumably been yanked away from his evening in order to arrange a trip to America for his boss's whatever I was. He took my passport from my unresisting fingers and went off to deal with the pilot for me. I perched on the edge of one of the leather sofas and stared blankly out of the floor-to-ceiling windows. Caspian's plane was waiting on the runway, a pale bird against the oily dark. Eventually, Belrose dropped down beside me and pushed a cup of something into my hands.
"I got you some tea. It's hot and milky, and you should drink it. And then I need you to listen to me."
I nodded, took a sip of tea. I wasn't particularly into the stuff, but it did actually make me feel slightly more human. Unfortunately, slightly more human meant full of fear and misery again, only wanting to be in Caspian's arms with all the badness of the world held at bay.
"I've got you a suite at the Liberty," Belrose was saying. "It's the closest decent hotel to the hospital. I'll also arrange for a car to meet you at the airport when you arrive."
I kept nodding.
"Do you have your phone with you? The one Caspian gave you?"
"Did I?" "Apparently I did. And my own, too. Go me in my brief moments of competence.
I've sent you all the details. And call Caspian when you land. He'll be worrying."
Caspian? Worrying? Okay.
"I don't suppose you thought to bring the credit card Caspian provided when you first moved into One Hyde Park?"
I honestly wasn't sure if I'd remembered to pack my socks. "I didn't think so. Here." Another card. Coutts, again. Quietly black on the reverse. An artfully faded image of a Chinese street on the front. The logo a flash of silver. You know I can't take his money. Belrose's lashes, which were reddish gold like his hair, fluttered, as if he was trying very hard not to roll his eyes.
"Given you don't have any of your own, you don't really have a choice."
"I do. I have £50.56.
"There's no shame in lack of money, just inconvenience. How are you intending to live in a foreign country on an income of nothing?"
"Very frugally.
Use the card."
He picked it up and slid it into my jacket pocket.
"If you don't take proper care of yourself, Caspian will be angry."
"With me?" I found myself blinking back fresh tears. Overwhelmed by, at this point, basically everything.
"Much more likely with me, since it's my job to ensure you don't starve to death in a gutter in Boston."
I cringed. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be difficult."
"Then might I recommend not being?"
"Oh, God!"
I wailed in unfocused despair.
"You hate me!"
"What does that have to do with anything?"
"I don't like it."
"Personally, I find the way people treat you when they don't like you infinitely preferable to their behaviour when they do." I burst into tears. There was a longish, well, not silence because I was sniffling into it, but a period of time in which I cried and Belrose sat there uncomfortably.
"Please stop doing that,"
he murmured. "You're getting salt in your tea."
I was trying to stop crying. I really was. Unfortunately, it didn't seem to be happening.
"For heaven's sake, I'm Caspian Hart's assistant. My opinion about anything is utterly irrelevant."
"Not to Caspian."
"Well, no.
But he does not consult me about his personal life, nor would I want him to. But you keep having to do all this stuff for me. Belrose half turned, and it was one of those moments where, despite the fact they looked nothing alike, he reminded me of Caspian. Beautiful, unassailable, and merciless. It's not for you. It's for him. I'm not sure whether that makes me feel better or worse. I did my best to present the tatters of a smile. All the same, I'm sorry I dragged you out. And on a Friday night as well. It's fine. But you could have been, I don't know, at a party or having sex. Actually, I was knitting. That surprised a snuffly laugh out of me. And then I realized he wasn't joking. You knit? What I do in my spare time is none of your business. But knitting? Seriously? That's... You do realize that's adorable, don't you? I think I preferred it when you were crying. The look Belrose was giving me would have clotted cream. Except he let himself be human with me, even if just for a moment. And I wasn't sure if I'd ever be properly scared of him again. You're so mean. Why are you so mean, Belrose? It gets things done. I rested my head on your shoulder. You know, you don't have to wait with me. You know I do. Time went all airporty, dragged its feet, slumbered in corners. But finally the plane was cleared for takeoff. I went through the last few checks and hurried outside after Belrose. He dealt with my luggage and was waiting for me by the door of the plane, only slightly ruffled by the wind and looking like a center spread from a milieu pull-out special on private jets. I clunked up to join him. Thank you for doing all this, and sorry for crying, and being awkward, and making a fuss about the credit card. I was such a nonsense person. When a man flew you across the world in his private jet so you could be with your friend, drawing a line at using his actual money was as hypocritical as it was futile. And I fully expected Belrose to point it out. But all he said was, "You will call him, won't you?" "Yes, as soon as I can. Make sure you do." Wow. Belrose was certainly, something. I grinned at him. He must pay you really well. Most likely. Or else you really love him. Shit! Shit! I couldn't quite believe I'd said that aloud. Belrose just smirked. "Not the way you do, Arden. Have a safe flight." Watching him descending the stairs with a sort of grace I could only dream of, I couldn't help thinking of Caspian, surrounded by glass and darkness and so many walls. "You'll take care of him, won't you?" I blurted out. He half turned. "Always." And then he vanished into the shadows between the runway lights. And I was alone. Well, apart from the pilot, and the cabin crew and all the other people Caspian was paying to attend to my every need. But, you know, emotionally speaking. We landed in Boston at around 7 a.m., or rather 2 a.m. EST, which was instant jet lag, my body insisting that there should be a morningness when it was still the middle of the night. I'd set an alarm for an hour before landing, which had given me the time to shower and de-rumple, but I still stumbled off the plane like a zombie who'd partied too hard. I couldn't tell if it was my brain being porridged or the inherent sameness of airports, but I didn't really feel as if I'd flown across the world, or that I was in another country. At least not until I had to talk to people who sounded like they'd left their R's in 17th century England. And then the realness of it all became almost uncopable with. Once my passport had been checked, luggage retrieved, and I'd been welcomed to the USA, I was whisked along gleaming concourses, past travellers and lingerers, and an honest-to-goodness Dunkin' Donuts stand, and finally bundled into a limo. It was a bit like being a rock star and a bit like being kidnapped. Although I would make a terrible subject for a kidnapping. I wasn't famous and my family wasn't wealthy. What were the perpetrators going to demand?
Bring us 1 million units of your best walnut bread and your copy of Twilight Imperium.
Or maybe Caspian would have to step in. Which sounded like the plot of a 5-episode post-Watershed BBC drama series. And viewers would write in and complain about the unnecessary homosexual content. Because being part of a clearly implausible kidnapping plotline was necessary, whereas kissing a man was totally gratuitous.
Oh, God! Brain, stop! Just stop!
My head was a ceaseless whirl. Disconnected frivolities flying about as chaotically as socks in the washing machine. It was probably a slightly unhinged defense mechanism, so I didn't have to think the only thought that mattered. Nick's in hospital, Nick's in hospital, Nick's in hospital. Also, the whole limo deal was extra awkward when there was only you. Maybe I should have felt like Mr. Big. Sweeping between skyscrapers in my long black penis car. But I was small. So small. The corridor of the limo rolling away from me. I tried to distract myself by looking out the window. Except it was hard to get a sense of the city beyond its difference. An alien glitterscape languidly sprawling up, across, around, careless of its own space. Disconcertingly uniform, too, with its neat red brick parcels and tall silver towers. This smooth curve of history, so unlike the haphazard patchwork of London. Ugh. I'd been in America less than an hour, and I was homesick. The drive was quicker than I was ready for it to be. Airport, tunnel, streets. And we arrived. The hospital was this vast campus, multi-building thing. Bright, shiny, and monstrous, the way that only public institutions could be. I de-limoed near the big red emergency sign and hurled myself into the building. Everything that followed was little more than a blur of happening. I checked in, my squeaky questions gently put aside for the surgeon. And was redirected. A horrible hell journey of slick grey tunnels and silver elevators, my nose full of hospital smell. I had to go through another round of identification at the ICU while I scoured my hands with sanitizer gel. Then another corridor, past the misted glass of waiting area, huddled shadows within. My footfalls silenced by vinyl as if I was already half ghost. And finally, I was there, standing in the doorway of a room. It was a nice room. It was. If you could look past the tangle of screens and equipment and mad scientist tubing, the white walls, the white sheets. And Nick was. Oh, God. The last time I'd seen him. So banal, really. A stilted airport parting that we'd both believed and not believed was a proper goodbye.
Shit, I better go,
he'd said. Travel safely, I'd answered. And that was it. I could vaguely remember him walking away, laptop bag swung across one shoulder. Lacrosse stick over the other, his shadow cast long against the epoxy shining floor like a sundial marking the hour. Now he was just a flop of blondish hair, cocooned in a hospital gown. I put my hand over my mouth because I wasn't sure I could even be trusted to breathe properly right then. After a moment or two, the doctor came. Introduced herself. Dr. Sharma, she said, and talked to me softly. There was good news. He was breathing by himself. No traumatic brain injuries. But there was other stuff. Broken legs, broken sternum, multiple rib and spine fractures, bone shards embedded in the spinal cord. "Is he going to die?" I asked.
"He's stable for now."
She said it so warily I realized I was asking the wrong thing. "Will he... he's going to get better, right?" Except that just made her repeat everything she'd previously said, with some extra stuff about titanium plates and potential compromise to the spinal cord. And that was when I knew I had to stop with the questions. It was too early for them, and the answers wouldn't tell me anything I didn't already guess. What mattered was the fact Nick was alive. "Can I go in?" She nodded and stepped away. And I hesitated, like a fucking worthless coward. I stood there, because crossing that threshold would mean this was really happening, and I didn't know how to bear it. I didn't want the future of that golden, laughing, ridiculously talented boy to be a shattered body in a hospital bed. Except it was, and that was that. And it didn't make him any less Nick. Step by step, then. Step by fucking step. A far longer journey than the one across the ocean. From the door to Nick. I slumped into the nearest chair. His hand was lying on top of the covers, looking so neat that it could only have been placed there. People were naturally messy. His symmetry was as terrifying as his stillness. I didn't dare actually move the hand. There were so many tubes sticking out of it, I'd probably have ended up killing him. But I covered it gently with my own. He felt strange. Not warm or cold. And very smooth, like plastic. "Jesus, Nick!" My voice came out far too loud for where I was, and I had to try again. "What the fuck? I told you to travel safely. This doesn't look anything like traveling safely. In fact, some people might call getting smashed up by a car the exact opposite of traveling safely." I don't know. It had to be wishful thinking, but I was sure I felt the slightest change in his pattern of breathing. Like maybe whatever he was dreaming had made him smile. It was, as nights went, shitty. Though obviously worse for Nick. Or maybe not, since he was unconscious, and I was sitting there painfully awake. He did stir sometimes, and talk to me. But he was living in fragments. The first time he asked where he was, which scared the shit out of me, especially because when I told him, as gently as I could, that he was in the hospital, he wanted to know why. And I didn't know how to explain to someone who'd been in a car crash about the car crash they didn't remember being in. Thankfully, he drifted off again almost immediately, and I ran in a panic for the doctor in case it was a traumatic brain injury thing after all. But apparently it was pretty normal. Next time his eyes opened, he seemed a touch more lucid. He blinked, the motion jerky and slow, as if it wasn't a reflex for him anymore.
"Dude, you look like shit."
"Dude, you're pissing into a bag." He made a barely there noise of amusement, and then seemed exhausted by it.
"Am I on a lot of drugs?"
he whispered, just when I'd thought he'd slipped away again.
I can't really feel anything.
Yeah, that's the drugs. Oh, wow. And the award for least convincing bedside consolation lie goes to Arden St. Ives. Nick's throat worked laboriously.
Are you really here? Not dreaming?
I'm here. Promise. I tightened my fingers over his. They twitched in response. Can you feel that?
Yeah.
That's me.
You won't leave?
Only occasionally to wee, and I'll have to check into my hotel. But I'll be super quick. He mumbled something I didn't catch and closed his eyes. But he slept more easily. And that was good. Right. He needed to rest and stuff. More than he needed the truth right then. Chapter 15. By the time dawn filled the room with fresh grey, Nick was still sleeping and I was beyond exhausted, sodden with it like heavy rain. I dozed off and on through the morning, but by early afternoon one of the nurses had pretty much ordered me out of the hospital, telling me I'd be useless if I didn't get some proper rest. Not sure where the hotel was, or even if I was capable of walking, I got the limo back, and discovered the place was literally just up the road, except I was too knackered to be embarrassed. I crawled out of the car and wove my way to the front desk, signed things and received my keycard and some other shit in a blur of words I barely understood. Lift, corridor, room, bed, face. I groped for my second phone, hit the shortcut for Caspian with a barely functional finger. He picked up immediately.
Are you all right?
I'm sorry, I slurred. I don't know what time it is. I heard him murmuring,
I'm sorry I have to take this.
And then to me,
it doesn't matter. How's your friend?
Kind of fucked, but alive and breathing. That's good, right?
Very promising.
I wasn't capable of much movement, but I managed to fold part of the duvet over me with some determined feet flapping. I'm really glad I'm here. Thank you for helping me.
It's nothing.
I'm too tired to argue, but it's not nothing. It only seems that way to you because you're used to being able to do stuff like this.
Being able to do something is simply a question of resources. Being willing to do it is a matter of heart.
His voice softened.
You chose to be with your friend when he needed you. I simply made it easier for you to get there.
Warmth crept through the corners of my tiredness. I guess. It's overwhelming, though, and I'm not sure what use I am to him right now.
Caring for others is not my field of expertise, but in Nick's place, I wouldn't need you to be useful. I'd need you to be there.
He'd done it again. Said the exact thing I didn't know I was desperate to hear. You're so wrong, Caspian. You make me feel very cared for. I heard him swallow, caught the uncertain tapping of his fingers against his desk.
You'll call as often as you can, won't you?
I promise.
You should rest now, though.
I rolled onto my back, let my sleep-hazy eyes take in the blandness of a hotel ceiling. I know, but...
What?
I don't want you to go. The words had escaped before I could stop them, and I cringed at how childish they sounded. But all Caspian said was,
Then I won't.
You can't just sit around on the phone with me.
I think you'll find that I can do whatever I like. And besides,
I somehow knew he was smiling.
You're practically unconscious. It'll probably only take 5 minutes.
I laughed, or whatever passed for a laugh when you were half drunk with sleepiness, and rolled myself up in the duvet. Caspian's breath was an intimate metronome against my ear. Tell me something.
What sort of thing?
Anything.
That's very helpful, thank you, Arden.
There was that self-conscious note in his voice, and as ever I found it a little bit adorable. What are you wearing?
I'm not sure this is really the time.
Not in a sex way. I just want to know.
Oh. Well.
A pause. Maybe he was checking.
A dark blue suit by Catherine Sargent, with a white shirt, a navy tie and a pink polka-dotted pocket square.
Pink, you say?
Dark pink. I think they call the shade French rose. Are you giggling?
Only a little bit. Mainly I'm imagining how hot you look. His tone grew stern.
You're supposed to be sleeping.
I know, but please don't stop talking to me. Through some complicated maneuvers with my toes, I managed to kick off my shoes and wriggle my feet out of my socks. I've never actually stayed in a hotel by myself before. It feels weird.
You get used to it.
It suddenly occurred to me that this was Caspian's life. A string of strange rooms. Here's hoping I don't have to. He was quiet for a moment. Then,
You know, you're not alone. I'm only a phone call away. And now that I think about it, I could be there in a few hours. Do you want me to?
No, I said quickly. I mean, thank you, but no.
Are you sure?
Yes, you generous madman! I put a hand to my mouth to stifle a slightly hysterical sound. I can't believe you were going to come out here because I implied a mild state of disorientation.
You sounded lonely.
I'm all right. And I've got you, haven't I?
Always, my Arden.
He'd made me smile, when 10 minutes ago I wouldn't have imagined it was even possible. Of course, it was immediately followed by a shard of guilt that I was smiling and flirting and being comforted while Nick was alone in a hospital bed. Although I also knew that was just my brain being mean to me. Nick wasn't going to get better or worse depending on how miserable I was. But then thoughts were thoughts and feels were feels, and if you were me, their power to influence each other was less than zero. How's London? I asked.
Much as you left it, I suspect. Warmish with some scattered showers.
How's the humidity? He thought about it.
About 60%. Now why are you laughing?
Because you are legit terrible at small talk.
And you, he said crisply, are legit terrible at going to sleep.
You'd better get on with lulling me, then. He gave an unlullful snort.
Is that what I'm doing?
Not right now. No. Another pause. He cleared his throat.
Lulling is quite difficult.
Tell me what you're looking at. What you're thinking. I closed my eyes and let the last 24 hours thunder through me and over me until I was dust. I just want to hear you.